And the best rap album is The Fugees.
Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you and take it slowly. Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you and make you one.
Hello, welcome back to Death with a Record. This is Jamie, and this week we're back in the 90s again, this time in New Jersey. The album we're talking about is Fugees, The Score, released on February the 13th, 1996 on Rough House Records. Ollie, 1996, it was the year United signed Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. What happened in music?
Well, yeah, away from the Premier League, the hip-hop, quite a sad place to begin, actually, is that the final Tupac studio album came out in February, which is called All Eyes On Me. And Tupac was, of course, murdered 7 months later in a drive-by shooting. And whilst there would be posthumous releases, this was the final album released in his lifetime. Other than that, you've got the likes of A Tribe Called Quest, The Roots, and Ghostface Killah bringing out records. There's a couple of hip-hop musicians that brought out significant sophomore albums in 96 as well. So Outkast dropped Atlians, which built on their promising debut and signalled that, you know, they'd be a major force for years to come. And after the brilliance of his debut, Illmatic, Nas released It Was Written this year, which by no means is a terrible album, but I definitely think it signalled that the heights of his previous effort would be almost impossible to maintain, and he kind of began the slide into mediocrity, which defines the middle section of his career, I think. Stuff like Stillmatic, Nostradamus, and I Am. And you know, if anybody wants to try and fire some shots at me for slagging off It Was Written, just go, I think it's like the third song on that album. It's called Street Dreams.
Oh, yeah.
Go give that a listen. There's quite an unfortunate interpolation of Sweet Dreams by the Eurythmics.
Actually, that album is actually not that bad. Like, yeah, it's decent, but no, you're right. If you point back towards that song.
For me, my two favourite hip hop albums from that year, without doubt, are Bahamadia's Collage and Wrath of the Math by Jeru the Damager, so they're definitely worth checking out. There's a few debuts I want to mention as well. So DJ Shadow brought out Introducing, which I know you're a big fan of, Jamie. And I know you're also a fan of this next group, although it's a bit of a gear change. Bell and Sebastian
brought out
Tiger Milk as well. Yeah, yeah, they were knocking about. And finally, I think it's pretty cool that 25 years on from bringing out her debut album, Tidal, Fiona Apple is still at the top of her game. She released an album last year called Fetch the Bolt Cutters, which finished top of the pile in a lot of end of year music publications like top 100 albums, etc., etc.
If you compare that with Weezer, who released Pinkerton this year, and now you look at what Weezer is still releasing, that is the exact opposite of being on the top of your game. My goodness me. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Some of the electronic music from this year is almost painfully 90s, I would say. You know, by the time The Score was released, Acid House was on its last legs in the UK, but a little film called Trainspotting, featuring Ewan McGregor, of course, had just launched Underworld to the top of the singles charts. So as a way of thinking about some of these releases, Jamie, what I want to know is, if you were off your nut at a rave in the 90s, which of these four tracks do you think you'd most want to hear?
Here we go.
So here we go. We've got Insomnia by Faithless.
Classic.
Underworld's Born Slippy, which is what I was just mentioning there. Block Rocking Beats by the Chemical Brothers. Or lastly, Fatboy Slim's Praise You.
Would you judge me if I went with Insomnia? I definitely think...
Nah, mate, definitely not.
I think maybe... You've seen him, right? Because I would like, Before I Die, do you reckon they could play the Legend slot at Glastonbury, something like that? I would love to see Insomnia live, man.
It was at my first ever festival. I think I was like 14 or 15, and I saw... And the person we were with, he was a bit older, and he was like, we need to go see Faithless. And this is really embarrassing. The Kooks were playing at the same time, and I was like, oh, I don't know, I kind of want to go see the Kooks. And he was like, nah, trust, come with me, we're going to go watch Faithless.
What year was this?
This must have been like 2010, 2009.
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched Insomnia on his shoulders, and it remains one of the most kind of like amazing gig or like festival moments of my life.
I bet.
So, yeah, I wouldn't judge you at all for going with that.
Great. Well, let's move on to talking about the album itself. I thought to begin our chat about this album, The Score, I think it's probably pretty vital that we discuss the name of the group, Fugees. So what this name means, what it can tell us about the origins of the project and their intentions as well. So the first iteration of this group, Ollie, actually emerged when Lauryn Hill was introduced to Praz through a mutual high school friend. So the two of them came up with this idea of a hip-hop group that would rhyme in different languages. They called themselves the Translator Crew. So you can already get a sense of this being quite a multicultural project. Anyway, quite soon after that, Wyclef, the other member of Fugees, joined the group. He replaced another female vocalist and they made a trio. So you have Praz, Lauryn Hill and Wyclef. And they began working on ideas in Wyclef's uncle's basement in South Orange, New Jersey. Crucially, both Praz and Wyclef identified strongly with their Haitian background. So a bit of context here, Ali. In the 1960s, there was a change in US immigration policies that basically led to a dramatic increase in immigrants from the Caribbean, a significant number of which ended up congregating in Brooklyn and the Bronx. So Praz was from one of these families. He was born in the borough of Brooklyn as a second generation immigrant. Wyclef, however, was actually born in Haiti and only moved to Brooklyn and then subsequently New Jersey when he was 9 years old, which is where the name Fugees comes in. So it's taken and then purposefully shortened from the slur refugee, which is a word that was used to refer to Haitian Americans in kind of a derogatory way. But that said, Ollie, obviously the word refugee has a broader context than just being referenced to Haitian Americans. It can basically mean, you know, anyone who's been displaced, anyone who's had to forge out a new home in a new country. And I think this broader meaning is important because Fugees' music, and definitely the score more than the debut, which we'll go into a bit later as well, you know, it's music that symbolizes the interconnectedness and scope of the African diaspora, which is to say, you know, there's a Caribbean element, there's an African-American element, there's all these musical styles that come from that, there's reggae, there's dancehall, calypso, hip-hop, soul, jazz, etc. So I think there's something in the name of the group that suggests they're reclaiming not just the word refugee, but also reclaiming the kind of immigrant musical history you can find running, often unacknowledged, through a lot of popular American music. So anyway, all that said, coming into this album in 1995, Fugees returned to Wyclef's uncle's basement studio. It's referred to as the Booga Basement by the group. They had a $135,000 advance and they went about recording new material for this album. Now I encourage everyone listening to this just to go and check out some videos of this studio, the Booga Basement. I think it's fair to say it was fairly DIY, which is what makes it so cool. This album went on to be really a massive, massive hit. We can't understate this during this episode. The score, I think it ended up selling more than 17 million copies. It went multiple times platinum. It made them all pretty much rich and famous. Anyway, Ollie, the question to open this episode that I want to ask you is, Wyclef uses the word eclectic to describe this musical style of Fugees. And what parts do you think of that immigrant and diasporic focus I was talking about do you think shine through on this album?
I think that lyrically, the immigrant experience is at the centre of this record, particularly with Wyclef. And I didn't actually know that he'd only moved to the US as a child and wasn't born there, so that kind of makes this even more interesting. A lot of his bars on the score are sad, they're upsetting, they're generally focused on feeling unwelcome and a sense of dislocation. His is almost like a kind of compounded misery because it's difficult and challenging enough being a young black man in the US anyway. And then on top of that, there's this double stigma because he's an immigrant.
Yeah.
I feel like Clef has a bit of a chip on his shoulder on the score. He feels like he has to prove himself on this record, prove that he's worthy of his place in hip hop in this country. And there's a bar from Zealots, I think, which summarizes this point quite well, where he says, "It hurts, doesn't it? A refugee come to your turf and then take over the earth." And I just think, sadly, this is just an inescapable part of the immigrant experience, like constantly having to prove your value or prove your worth, you know, in the country that you've moved to. So that's what stands out to me from a lyrical perspective. I think production-wise, as you've mentioned, you know, the influence of the African diaspora can be heard on this record. And, you know, I feel like people might look at the fact that there's a Bob Marley cover, for example, on the score and think that's what we're talking about. I think we agree that it goes way beyond that. It's not necessarily like there's this overwhelmingly reggae or calypso feel to tracks, but it's there in the noises, the sound effects, the choruses, the samples, which, you know, is slightly inevitable given that this record was predominantly produced by Wyclef, his cousin Jerry Wonder, and then with Salaam Remy acting as a kind of mentor for Fugees in this time period. So, you know, the people who listened to our first series might remember that we, you know, spoke a bit about Salaam Remy on our episode on Amy Winehouse. And, you know, Remy's basically built a name for a reggae-tinged style of hip-hop production. And I think it's significant that he was working as a kind of mentor for Fugees while they were making the score.
There's some quite funny and very apt quotes about Salaam Remy, and someone describes him as kind of being like the green card for Jamaican artists. And Remy himself says, a lot. He describes the score as, you know, a lot of these songs were stuck at the airport, so to speak, and I got them visas that helped them get through. Which to me, I guess, suggests, right, that like you have Wyclef's maybe origins and interest in Caribbean music, but you need a figure like Salaam Remy as an overseer to be able to guide you towards making this stuff maybe more accessible for American audiences.
Yeah.
To give you a funny example of that, I mean, I'm not sure if you know this, but earlier on in their career when they played live, they would basically start, it would be Praz and Wyclef would be out the front and Lauryn Hill wouldn't even be on stage. They'd then bring a goat out onto their stage, as like a way of giving prop to their Haitian roots. So they'd have...
I mean, fair enough.
Yeah, it would be Praz, like Wyclef, and this goat on stage, just kind of... And obviously people like, what the fuck is going on? And then Lauryn would start singing, and then from backstage, and then she'd come on. And obviously then I think people start to be a bit more interested in it. But I think they ditched the goat shtick quite soon after that. But it definitely sums up maybe like...
I would quite like to have seen that make a reappearance at the Grammys or something though.
That yeah, or maybe on Jules Holland, something like that. That would be great. But I mean, yeah, like despite all this, you know, we're talking about Salaam Remy. I think maybe it's his influence that makes it this album... Also quite poppy, you know, as much as it has these other stuff, it's also quite an accessible album and it's aged well in that sense. Given all that, it's also quite funny how, you know, given how popular it was, it's also quite a conceptually ambitious album in a way that might kind of put some people off. I mean, Lauryn Hill referred to the album as a quote, an audio film. She said she wanted it to basically tell a story. She intended it to be like how radio was kind of back in the 1940s. She also makes a wild comparison and says she wanted to make it the hip hop version of Tommy by The Who. For people who don't know that album, it's a kind of rock opera narrative story about this character, this deaf, dumb and blind child called Tommy. I mean, I think that's an interesting comparison.
Yeah, I would not have predicted Lauryn Hill to make that link, but yeah fair enough.
I would say I'm slightly skeptical of the comparison. I'm skeptical maybe of how much of a narrative really runs through the score as an album. But that said, I definitely feel like it has a kind of radio station sound. There are so many samples, so many references, so many interpolations on this record. It's almost ridiculous to a point. And the word that leaps to my mind, Ollie, rather than audio film, is maybe like an audio collage. Am I talking rubbish there, or do you know what I mean?
I'm not really convinced that there's a firm narrative going through the record in the way that film would suggest, because I don't think the score is quite on that level of conceptual album. But, you know, if you're thinking about the way that songs on the record sample each other, there's a lot of repeated hooks, a lot of choruses throughout. So there might be like a Fuji La chorus on, you know, a different song on the record. Then, yeah, I think collage is a pretty accurate description. I'm glad you brought a radio, to be honest, because I feel like this is quite a good way to describe it. And I don't mean what I'm about to say in a demeaning sense at all. I think there's quite a Grand Theft Auto vibe
interesting.
To the score, if you get me. Like, you know, if you're driving around in Grand Theft Auto in a car and you can pick the radio station that you like, it wouldn't surprise me if something like the score was playing on a hip-hop station. The way that the skits are quite violent and humorous and kind of run into one another, the vibe of the record is maybe where like this conceptual idea comes in, rather than it having like a narrative arc or a story.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you mentioned it briefly there. On the song, the score, they literally interpolate their own songs off this actual album. You know, it's like they're basically saying, you know, we're creating classics here, so we're just going to we're going to sample ourselves on our own fucking album, which I just love so much. To kind of list off some of the other funny and quite unexpected sample moments, there's a moment where Lauryn starts singing to the tune Fire and Rain by James Taylor. Wyclef starts singing Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell. There's Benita Applebaum references here. Francisco Torrega, the classical guitarist as well. So there's all this random kind of snippets like fading in and out, which, yeah, I agree, gives it that radio kind of feel. Ollie, what would be your favourite tracks on the album then?
I think I've got to shout out How Many Mics. Each of the Fugees absolutely kill their verse, and it really makes you sit up and say, okay, this is where the level is at now, because they each easily surpass anything that was on their debut, Blunted on Reality. You know, surely one of the best things about a hip-hop group with numerous MCs is that you can get different flavors, different styles from each member. You know, if you look at a group like Wu-Tang, then, you know, even though they're all performing under one umbrella, they have specific individual qualities to the rapping that makes each of them distinctive. It's exactly the same with Fugees, and this song is just a really good example of that. Like Lauren, I don't know whether I've heard a more harmonious verse than on this song. Like, I'd have to give that some thought, and just kind of sets the tone for the rest of her sections. You know, Clef, by comparison, comes in with something slightly more yappy and high-pitched, but I think the two of them complement each other really well. You know, maybe a slightly lazy comparison, but it's almost like a kind of Tip and Fife thing.
I was thinking that as well, definitely. Yeah, I don't think it's a lazy comparison.
And then Praz, like, as he does on tunes throughout the record, just kind of closes things off in his own fashion. And I think it shows how little ego there must have been from him, because most of his verses are usually half as long as the others, probably even shorter, but he just makes these distilled mic drops his trademark. And as good as the other two are on how many mics, I think his verse is probably my favorite. Many money, say me say many, many, many. How many mics do I rip on the deli? Many money, say me say many, many, many. How many mics do you rip on the deli? Many money, say me say many, many, many. How many mics do we rip on the deli?
In terms of that song, we have to mention the hook. Like, it's just so catchy. And in terms of opening up an album, as you say, I can't imagine anything that would be more effective just pulling you into something so immediately. Like, another probably favourite song of mine on that album is The Beast, which has the same thing. Just an unbelievable hook. And it's true for so many of the songs on this album. And I think maybe that's part of why it was so popular and why it sold so well. It's really catchy, and if there's one thing Fugees can do well, it's write really, really catchy hooks.
Mate, Lauren on The Beast, she is
unbelievable.
Like, even by her standards on this album, I think that's probably her at, like, approaching her peak. Have you got any other favourite tracks?
Kind of being very biased towards the front end of this album, and there are some amazing tunes on the second half as well, but in forms of another banger, it has to be Zealots. I think it has one of my favourite Clef verses on the album. He's kind of referencing Greek myth and astronomy all in the same verse. It's pretty esoteric. I think the other thing as well, and I have to say this, you know, we've talked a bit about the sampling on this album without maybe going into too much detail about how and why it works. I think what's really unique about what they're doing is, like, you know, let's say you're a producer and you grab like a 4-bar sample, you splice it up, you add some drums, and there's your beat. Mm. That in itself is a talent and can produce some amazing songs. But what Fugees do is they do that, and instead of leaving it as it is, over the top they'll have Lauren singing like another melody that she's taken from a different point of the same song. And because she's such a talented singer, she can add her own embellishments to it. And then meanwhile, Clef is singing some random hook he's interpolating from a different 70s reggae track or something, and he's also playing a guitar part from another song. So you have all these layers of about 6 different songs all working together to create something that's seriously special. And this is a great example on the song Zealots. The main sample for the beat is from the Flamingo song Only Have Eyes For You.
The magazine says the girl should have went solo. The guy should stop rapping, vanish like a noodle. Took it to the heart, but every actor plays his part. As long as someone was listening, I knew it was the start. For me to get my chance, grab my pen and revamp. Do a cameo while everybody do the dance. Quit now, cause you're running out of luck. Playing Mr. Big, I'm gonna get you.
I'd say that's my favourite beat on the record, hands down. And you know, I listen to the Flamingos track and you just think, like, how the fuck has someone heard this and thought, yeah, let's build a hip-hop beat around that?
Of all the things to sample from that song as well, you could listen to that tune and it's an amazing song, I recommend you guys do it, but you to pick out what they picked out so perfectly, I think it's a special talent, and that's probably the thing that I find most satisfying about this album is the way that they pick from all these different sources and layer them on top of each other. And instead of just doing it in the conventional sense of sampling a beat and spicing it up, they add their own embellishments because they're both such talented musicians, Lauren and Clef, this is. Anyway, right, it is a hip-hop album, so we've got to do our favorite lyric or bar as well.
Well, I'm going to go for a slightly interesting one here. So I'm going with a Praz one for a start from How Many Mics. And it goes,
that is rogue.
It is a bit rogue. And he says, and my panache will mosh your entourage, squash the squad and hide their bodies under my garage. And I reckon in post-production, we're going to have to try and edit him saying that rather than me, because I really haven't done it justice at all.
And my ponage will march your entourage, squash the squad and hide their bodies under my garage.
There's a couple of things going on here. The first is that this bar has been sampled by one of my favourite techno producers, Blauwan, in a track called Why They Hide Their Bodies Under My Garage, which I'm pretty sure I must have pissed you off at some point playing at, like, you know, stupid o'clock in the morning after a night out a bit too loud, Jamie. But
mate, well, I it's so funny you say that. I have, not only that, I have a very distinct memory of when we were living together, of you going, Jamie, mate, come upstairs, listen to this. And I'm like, I'm not sure what time it was, but you were listening to that track and you were like, mate, right, listen to this. And then you played it, and then you played the Praz verse. We're like, look, it's from this song, mate. Oh my God. Yeah, cool. Yeah, it's a good song. I'm not sure if you remember that. But.
Well, yeah, I don't, but I could definitely envisage that something like that happened. So yeah, I've got a bit of a soft spot for it, for that point of view. But I also wanted to go with the Praz bar, because I feel like he's one Fuji that is kind of overlooked. And it's easy to speak about Lauryn Hill and her incredible voice and clef and, you know, him being the consummate musician and whatnot. But Praz has, he's got a great voice, you know, he's like a deep baritone that reminds me of Charlie Tuna from Jurassic 5, and also Roots Maneuver from These Shores, actually, especially with kind of the patois rhyming schemes. And, you know, I think it's funny that he was essentially viewed within Fugees as the businessman, quote unquote, and he was there to kind of talk contracts and talk record deals with executives. But I don't think we should overlook his contribution to the group from a musical perspective either.
Yeah, I've never really understood this, because I've read this quite a few times in various books and articles written about Fugees, where it's like, yeah, Praz, like, wasn't really much of a rapper. He was the businessman of the group. Yeah, he looked after the business-facing side of the process. It's like, what? And I'm not sure the exact details, but you were telling me, is it like the Enya sample on Ready or Not, right?
It's the beginning part of the song, isn't it? The do, do, do.
The only, like, so-called business decision I've ever actually seen explicitly written about that Praz supposedly made was to use that sample without clearing it. And if I remember this correctly, didn't that end up costing them like $4 million or something?
Yeah, it cost them $1 million each, which, yeah, a bit peak.
In Forms of My Own Lyric, I had to go one from Lauryn, sorry. I think she's somehow obviously the best singer on this album, and also I think arguably the best MC. Her lyric on I'm Ready or Not, so why you're imitating Al Capone, I'll be Nina Simone and defecating on your microphone.
So why you imitating Al Capone, I'll be Nina Simone and defecating on your microphone. Ready
or not. I think that's such a call to arms of kind of step aside gangster rap. Lauryn Hill is here, she's about to take over pop music, and she's going to do it in the way that Nina Simone did. And of course she went on to do that. Also, very quickly, have to give a shout out to the Fugee La Refugee Camp remix. I know it doesn't really count and it's on the extended edition, but Lauryn's verse on that remix is probably my favourite on the album and a favourite verse in the kind of Fugees catalogue. So if you haven't heard it, go and check it out. To kind of round off the album section, we always ask this question about an album. Sometimes we can't really think of any, but do you think there's any duds on your opinion on this album? Any songs you're not too keen on?
For me, there's quite a glaring one. No Woman, No Cry. I've got absolutely no problem with the group's deference to Marley. You know, Fugees are a group influenced by reggae music, and Marley's name is intimately woven into the genre. But did they really need to cover No Woman, No Cry? And, you know, swapping Trench Town for Brooklyn, it's just a bit forced, it's a bit cringy. I genuinely think the track is a mess, and thankfully it's the only blip.
Of all the Bob Marley songs to cover, forgive me for using this word, it's a bit bait, isn't it? And I think given how like interesting and inventive they've been throughout the rest of the album, with the way that they draw from other sources, to then cover No Woman, No Cry does feel maybe a bit cheap.
Yeah, I felt like they'd left that kind of stuff unblunted on reality, but it seems like some of it's kind of sneaked its way onto the score as well.
What was the lawsuit about?
Simple, we sampled Enya and we didn't clear it. We lied about it. And she was like, okay, take the shit off the album. We couldn't. Well, write me a big check. And we did.
Do you remember how big the check was?
About $3 million.
$3 million.
Yeah, because you're taking someone's copyright and you not clearing it, and then you lie about it on top of it. We didn't know.
Whose idea was it to lie about the
same? Mine. So I take responsibility for that.
Okay.
Because she lived in Ireland. So I said, yo, where is this album going to blow up? But nobody in Ireland going to hear this album. And she was number one in Ireland.
Apex is usually the segment where we try to decide where a particular album falls in the artist's career. Is it their peak? Is it at the Mount Everest, the pinnacle? Or is there another album that claims that title? First, very quickly, to run through Fuji's discography. Obviously, their debut album, Planted on Reality, was released in February of 1994. The follow-up, The Score, we're talking about today, was released 2 years later in February of 1996. Following that, there was a bootleg compilation that came later that year, and then finally, their only ever release came almost a decade later in 2005 with the pretty half-assed comeback single, Take It Easy. Obviously, the first two releases should really be considered for Apex, and I'd say even more obviously, their Apex is The Score. I mean, it's just blatant.
It's pretty easy.
I thought instead of breaking it down, which is basically the most obvious Apex debate we've had in the history of this podcast. I don't even think me and you could disagree on this one. I thought it'd be better just to chat about why exactly The Score ended up being so much better than their debut. Because I think it's quite a rare thing for a band that releases an album as classic as The Score to not really show any signs of that level on their previous album. To make a kind of slightly stupid example, Pablo Honey,
Jamie Cameron example.
Hear me out. Even the biggest Radiohead fanboy would not try and say that Pablo Honey is their best album. But they're also, if you listen to that, there are signs of what is to come over the next 20 years of their career. What is interesting to me about Blunted and Reality is that the album has barely any kind of fingerprints or notable elements that then would be developed on this subsequent album. There's no melody on it. There's none of that kind of interesting sampling and beat making. And I think if it wasn't for the Refugee references, to me at least, it'd be hard to link it to The Score at all. So Ollie, what do you think of that debut, and why do you think it feels so disconnected from The Score?
I don't think there's one aspect of Blunted on Reality that I prefer to The Score. From an individual MC and a production perspective, I think they massively develop from the debut. As you said, I've been trying to think about why that could be. I think one thing is that the Fugees have said, in hindsight, that they ceded way too much control in terms of production on Blunted on Reality. And that's probably why they went the other way and kind of really hunkered down in the Booga basement for The Score. And as you were saying in the intro, it sounds like an amazing situation. They had like 135 grand's worth of equipment sat in a garage, protected by a couple of Wyclef's uncle's dogs. Wyclef's auntie was like cooking Haitian food for anybody who was there, whether that be, you know, Fugees, Diamond D, a New York producer, a young Akon was knocking about as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems like there is an incredible sense of family and belonging. You know, they're pretty much all foreigners. It's very much a kind of us against the world kind of vibe. And it seems like if they were going to fail, then at least it would be on their own terms. And obviously, you know, they didn't. It was a huge success. I think the other thing is that although their debut was released in 94, it was actually recorded a couple of years prior to that, which would make Lauren about 17 or 18. And, you know, no offense to any child prodigies out there who might be listening, but that is maybe a little bit too young to, you know, be hitting your peak or creating a masterpiece. Because, you know, if you think about Lauryn Hill as a musician or a singer or a rapper, she was bound to break through into the mainstream at some point. And I think it's significant that I was talking about How Many Mics earlier. She delivers the first verse of the album, and she generally has all the hooks and all the big moments on the hits as well. You know, she sings the chorus on Ready or Not. She sings the chorus on Fuji La, Killing Me Softly. She does everything on there. Like, it takes some bottle, I think, to cover Roberta Flack and pull it off. And she manages to do that. And, you know, I'm not saying for 1 minute that Praz and Clef were like, you know, Lauren, these are going to be our big hits. You know, you should handle the big moments, because in no planet would Clef ever want the limelight kind of taken away from them like that. But I think whether through talent or force of personality or look, or probably, you know, a combination of all three, she is all over the big moments on this record. And I think that's ultimately a massive part of why this album was so successful.
In hindsight, it almost feels like, why would you not try and, I mean, I guess, as you say, she was only 17, but she was such a talented singer. I'm not sure if you realise this all, but at the time she was like starring in movies as well. She's been in like Sister Act 2. Mm-hmm. She was studying at Columbia, so she's an Ivy League education as well. She basically had everything going for her. And it feels so strange to me that on that debut, which the only adjective I can think of to describe it would be shouty. There's a lot of shouting on it. Why they wouldn't utilise this sense of melody that obviously Clef and Lauren particularly have, because they're so talented in that regard. The only other thing I can think of is maybe, you know, why the debut was just so mediocre and why the score ended up being the classic that it was, is that it came at almost the perfect point, right? You know, you talked in the intro in the Year in Music section, this album came out, and then what, within 6 months Tupac had been murdered, 6 months later Biggie died as well. So you have this gangster rap style that maybe the debut was trying to aspire to, and then that, signified by the death of Biggie and Tupac, kind of ends, and then the emergence of another era begins with the score. And I think they position themselves as a positive alternative to that kind of gangster violence.
Yeah.
In a way that definitely contributed to their success, if you know what I mean.
I've seen Praz and Clef talk about this actually, and they basically said that with Blunted on Reality, they kind of missed the boat slightly. And I think you're spot on. I think the score did just come at that perfect kind of crossover point. They were right on the threshold and kind of like ushered in a new type of hip hop.
Yeah, which I think a type of hip hop which has stayed with us today. Because I mean, if you go back and listen to gangster rap of that era, it's not that it's aged poorly. It's just that it feels very of that time. Mm. Whereas I feel like the score could be released tomorrow, and I think it would still be a massive fucking hit. Wyclef, at least in his side of it, in the production, I think he predicted a lot of stuff about where hip hop was going. You know, in the fact that he's a multi-instrumentalist, he wasn't afraid to play guitar and sing and play piano while also rapping. That's kind of where a lot of hip-hop has gone over the past 5 or so years. Are we kind of prepared to say that the score is the apex, obviously, and maybe one of the more forgettable debuts?
I think that's probably one of the most amicable apex conversations we've ever had, because we're in firm agreement.
Let's not kind of get ahead of ourselves.
There's still time for us to fall out, so you never know.
I mean, basically when I started this first goal, I was still in high school, because I was, 16 years old, just happy to be in a studio and singing and making music. We came a long way, we went from having an album that didn't do, incredibly well, but people knew about us, and we were able to take our stage show, and then we were able to do the sophomore album, which was The Score, and that was cool because I was a little bit older, so I started to get a little more knowledgeable about the studio and what I was doing. It was a challenge, doing this solo joint, but it was something that I felt was necessary.
Moving on to Alternate Cuts, given that we've spent the last half hour almost universally praising Fugees and actually getting on quite well with one another, in our next segment, we want to bring things back to reality a touch. Alternate Cuts is the section of the podcast where we tackle some of the major criticisms surrounding the artist and reflect on how the record connects to wider culture. Now, Jamie, if you were at the 39th Grammy Awards back in February 1997, you would have watched Fugees scoop a couple of prizes that evening, most noticeably pipping the likes of Tupac, LL Cool J, and A Tribe Called Quest to Rap Album of the Year. Combined with the score's phenomenal commercial performance, you might have thought, that the group's narrative for the rest of the 90s and beyond would probably read something close to world domination. Mm. And whilst Lauryn Hill fulfilled this prophecy with her 1998 Miseducation record, it needs to be remembered that, as you've already mentioned, as a collective, this was the last album Fugees would release. In fact, since that night, there's been, basically nothing from them apart from the bootleg album and that pretty crap single released in 2005. This might appear strange for a hip-hop group that essentially had the world at their feet, but I think even a cursory glance of Fugees' internal dynamics makes it obvious why there was no other option than to self-destruct. We spoke in the album section about how the three members kind of fitted seamlessly in a musical sense, but by contrast, personal relationships in the group were disintegrating rapidly. Whilst it isn't in our nature to engage in salacious gossip, the fact of the matter is that a decent chunk of the breakdown is linked to the romantic relationship between Wyclef and Lauren. Again, the last thing I want is to sound like we're doing some kind of collaboration with Heat magazine. So I'm going to try and keep this brief. Wyclef and Lauren began seeing each other prior to the score, whilst Wyclef was in a relationship with another woman. He then proceeded to get married to this woman and ended things between him and Lauren. Their relationship was, rekindled during the making of the score. Lauren became pregnant, told Clef that the child was his, only for Rohan Marley, who's Bob Marley's son, to be the actual father. You know, the internet can be an endless pit for rumours and stories of this kind, but I'm kind of hoping that, you know, my heavily abridged version of events just gives an idea of how messed up things became. And, you know, the following years have offered ample opportunity for, you know, both sides to fire shots. Wyclef released a memoir in 2012, which kind of details his side of things. And if you want Lauren's version of events, then I'd recommend giving Lost Ones off the Miseducation album a listen. Jamie, a recurring theme from series one that also became a kind of Death with the Record motto was, under no circumstances should you ever share a musical project with a lover. It is destined to end badly. Are Fuji's just another example to kind of add to the growing list, or the bonfire, if you will?
Well, as you say, right, this dynamic popped up a lot in series one. It became almost the Death of the Record motto. I think if you particularly you listen to the Stereo Lab episode and the Cocteau Twins episode, obviously those are two groups which are built around a romantic partnership and a musical partnership as well. I think it can be a dangerous game to play armchair psychologist with these kind of dynamics, because obviously invariably they're always more complex than what we could see as outsiders. That said, I'm going to play armchair psychologist. I'm kind of joking, but I know this idea of like conflicting creative forces. You have two figures, right, with different ideas, a distinct set of skills, but then maybe matching levels of creativity or certainly ego in this case. It's basically a tale as old as music itself, isn't it? Like almost all the big groups in history have had it. The Beatles, probably most famously, the John and Paul dynamic, and obviously they weren't a romantic couple, but that bond was definitely as foundational as any relationship. And I won't bother to list off all the other examples, but there are a lot of them. To apply that to the score, obviously those two main creative forces, no offense to Praz's business kind of acumen that we've mentioned earlier, are Wyclef and Lauryn Hill. Basically, could you make the argument that the intensity of their romance and those feelings that they had for each other brought a certain intensity and magnitude to the album as well? Like, to give you an example, Praz recounts one instance of Clef breaking up with Lauryn moments before she enters the booth to record Ready or Not. Hill's kind of crying her eyes out as she sings the hook, and then one of those takes ends up on the record. It's this question, right, of does conflict and trauma sometimes create good art? And obviously it's a huge question, so I've kind of set you up to fail here. But do you think it's wrong to suggest something like that might be going on here?
I understand what you mean. I think for the case of the Fugees, that assertion makes me quite uncomfortable, because I feel like it glamorizes the idea that musicians, and in this case Lauryn Hill, need to be in pain or like positions of abuse in order to make great music. And considering what I've read about Wyclef, it makes me feel slightly uneasy. What I do absolutely think, though, is that the competitive streak in both of them must have pushed this album forwards in terms of the intensity and the magnitude that you've mentioned. You know, these are two figures in Lauryn Hill and Wyclef who were massively creative, talented, and basically jostling for supremacy. For me, it makes complete sense that that would then be translated into, you know, the score going on to do what it's done.
Which also leads into the reason why they've ended up breaking up and never really having a successful reunion. I think once Lauryn had the success she did with Miseducation and Lauryn Hill, there was almost never a chance of a reasonable reunion, because the power dynamics had just shifted too much, right? Because I think going into this album, and for a certain period after its release, this album being the score, I think people and the music press were lauding Wyclef was the genius. He was this band who could play every instrument. He can sing in four or five different languages. I think the fact that he's a man is obviously important as well. I think people were a bit more ready to crown a male figure as a genius at that time than they would have been Lauryn. And I think a lot of people, even though, as we've already mentioned, Lauryn had the big moments in this album, she was the star. I think a lot of people were still saying, yeah, she's a star, but it's only because Clef has kind of harnessed her talent. And I think that pissed Lauryn the fuck off, like, understandably. And I think combined with their romance and the adultery that we won't go into, I think that definitely pushed Lauryn in her career to prove to everyone and prove to Clef, I'm the genius, I'm the one that carried that group, and I deserve my recognition. I think she proved that with Miseducation. What she's gone on to do in her career is another question. And obviously, you should check out the Death of the Record YouTube channel for a video that we've done this week on Lauryn Hill's career since the score. I just think it's such a difficult circumstance and situation, and I will never expect to see a reunion in any regard. Do you agree?
I remember you telling me about a quote, was it from Praz, that He felt that George Bush and Osama bin Laden were more likely to have a coffee together than he was to do a reunion tour with Lauryn Hill. Have I got that right?
Yeah, bin Laden and George Bush more likely to have a latte in Starbucks than they would Fuji's have a reunion. So.
Yeah, that kind of, I mean, at least, you know, linking back to Stereolab that we covered last year, you know, they're at least still touring, but that is pretty definitive nail in the coffin, I'd say, for Fuji's. Anyway, to end our podcast, we're going to imagine a situation where the score and its cover is trying to get into a nightclub, but Jamie and I are the bouncers. Now, the artwork isn't being judged on whether, you know, the three of them have got a credible ID, but a few different criteria. Aesthetics, originality, harmony between music and artwork, and whether or not the score could be considered an iconic cover. Now, there are four ranks to our nightclub. The first is GOAT, highest level Hall of Fame, no questions asked. The second, VIP, so it's not quite on GOAT level, but you know, they'll have their own table, they might have a few sparklers, etc. The third is ticket on the door, just about sneaking in. You know, Jamie's turned his back and I've kind of said, come on, get in while he's not looking. The fourth, name's not down, you're not coming in, get lost. Don't be trying to join the back of the queue because, you know,
you're just
embarrassing yourself. Anyway, so to go back to the score, as we've already said, the success of this album with, you know, however many million copies sold means that I think this is one of the most recognizable covers from the 90s as a decade. I don't know about you, Jamie, but I feel like I recognized the artwork a long time before I actually listened to the record.
Yeah, I get you.
That's probably tied to the prevalence of channels like MTV back in the day. Like they were probably around about their peak, right, in this kind of era.
Mm.
Speaking about the score's cover specifically, I think the similarity between that and Francis Ford Coppola's 1972 film cover for The Godfather are pretty obvious, both in terms of font and the floating heads on a dark background. Now, I hear some of you saying that, you know, maybe this cements the idea of the album as an audio film, and therefore, you know, this means that there's a good harmony between music and artwork. But I'm not so convinced. I think if you set out to create an audio film or a hip hop movie or whatever you want to call it, it seems a bit basic to use The Godfather, one of the most famous and critically acclaimed and popular films of all time, as your primary visual inspiration. And, you know, aside from Fuji's clearly trying to place their album in that level of artistic bracket, you know, what the fuck does The Godfather really have to do with this record? As a result, I don't think this album is doing bits for originality or aesthetics. And I think that whilst the harmony between music and artwork is there, it's a bit basic, let's be honest. I will concede that this is an iconic cover. That much is beyond doubt. But do you think that's enough to get the trio into our nightclub?
Okay, well, I agree. This is one of those cases where the cover has become iconic by virtue of the music rather than the two working in harmony or the cover being special on its own merit.
Hmm.
That said, don't do this to me again, Ollie. Like, to quote The Godfather, every time I get out, you pull me back in, man. Like, it's got to get in on the door. Come on.
I'm not saying it shouldn't get in. I'll let it in on the door, but I don't want to be hearing any VIP chat like Amy Winehouse. That's all
oh,
I'm saying,
man. God. When are we going to get over this? My God.
I told you we'd fall out before the end of the episode.
Speaking of the Godfather thing, there's an irony, right, in the fact that they're supposed to be kind of putting gangster rap to rest and they fucking reference Godfather. Yeah, it is just bait. I mean, I can't disagree, but it's got to get in on the door because even if it is because of the music, the fact that it's become iconic, it has such a scale. If we're going to play Top Trumps, which is a game that you enjoy a lot, surely the iconic rating would be so high that there'd be no choice but to let it in.
We're gonna let the score in. It's in on the door.
Cool. Also, very quickly, just made me realise, our first kind of product we can sell to our fans of the podcast to monetize it can be a Death of the Record album cover nightclub Top Trumps edition.
Oh my god.
How amazing would that be? How amazing would that be? God.
You're inspired, oh. You're a genius. Let's end this podcast right here and just start making it.
Let's do it. I'm so excited. Top Trumps. Right, this has been Death of the Record. This has been The Score. It's in on the door. I think we can can settle with. I'm not going to try and argue for VIP, just to maintain good relations. Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you next week.
Fake bullets can't scar me. I can spell a week out like Safari. Play you out like Atari. Sacrifice you, Harry Carvey. And I'm sorry to every single rapper, Dick and Harry, saying they want to spar me because I think my repertoire and my memoir be reminding me of eating calamari in the Kalahari with a band of Rastafari. So, ha ha ha, you shouldn't diss refugees and your whole sound set routine.
Ooh la la la, it's the way that we rock when we